I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. My armor's probably cooler, and I don't follow direction. Like, you've got a map where you think I can go, and I'm just going to throw that. I'm just going to rip it up and replace it with something that I've drafted up. I really like him.
Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun. The officially unofficial TV show for the book called Shogun, or I guess for the miniseries, the sequel to the miniseries, the remake of the miniseries of the book Shogun. I'm Jim.
This has really broken your brain, man. I'm Aaron.
Yeah, it's too many. I've gone too many layers deep on the Matrix here, and I can't handle it.
This is for Aaron, the Ringer Prestige podcast, is what I understand.
Yes.
Wow, what a high honor. Thank you, Spotify.
We're here for episode 3. Tomorrow is tomorrow. Aaron, what'd you think about this episode?
I thought it was great. It's of a piece of the other episodes. They keep throwing my favorite things into it. Got a lot of archery in this one. Got a lot of ship sailing. Got a square rigged ship versus a rowing galley. I mean, doesn't get any better than that. Pretty good action sequences. A daring and amusing switcheroo. Tricksy little deception by Toranaga. I'm completely in the tank for this show. It's gorgeous. The armor is so fucking sweet. Talk 30 minutes about Yabashiga's armor in particular, and his helmet with the crazy horsehair coming out of it. Oh, it's so cool. What'd you think?
I'm with you. I mean, I'm not as enamored by the sailing stuff, and I guess I don't understand a lot of the sailing stuff, and I'll have questions for you. Hopefully you know not just about sails but about oars as well. I really like this episode. I thought the trick that they pull to get Toranaga out of the city, out of the castle, was pretty sweet. I have some, like, a little personal bugaboos with some parts of that, but overall, I really enjoyed that. I thought it was clever and exciting, and sets us up oh so well for what I assume is just a war to come. I mean, he's staffing up his army. He's training up his army. I feel like he knows what's on the horizon here, and he's preparing for it. So I am too, and I'm excited about it. This is a really good episode.
Yeah, and I love how we've gone from the other four regions just slapping themselves on the back and I can't believe Toranaga's just going to go along with our little plan. Wow, we've got him boxed in, no recourse here, and he just flip-flop, floop, and he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone, he's also thrown a monkey wrench into their plans. I mean, like, they don't have the power to do anything right now, which I think is interesting, but I guarantee it won't stay that way for long. This is a delay tactic, not a, gotcha, I win.
But I do think that he's put himself in a really strong position where Ishido and his flunkies are, like, divided and tied up. And, like, because, you know, they also established these guys as bureaucrats, and now Toranaga is doing the warrior thing and, like, hey, you can stamp your papers and you can try to do this, try to do that, but it's going to be a week before you can probably even agree to vote for someone to remove me, much less execute me. Yeah. Also, I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. My armor's probably cooler, and I don't follow direction. Like, you've got a map where you think I can go, and I'm just going to throw that. I'm just going to rip it up and replace it with something that I've drafted up. I really like him. He's such an interesting mix of, like, a Ned Stark and a Tywin Lannister type, where he's got, like, all the honor, all the brains, all the cunning, and pretty handy with a sword, too. He did some work in that ambush.
Oh, yeah. I was waiting for him to uncork, and I think he did. He looks like he's a badass. But it's unfortunate he does so in an episode where there is a bigger badass to talk about. in the form of Buntaro, which I don't know how I feel about this guy. I'm torn on everybody, right? Like, I look at Torunaga and I think, oh, this is a guy that I could follow. This is a guy with principles. This is a guy who is smart and is able to navigate some very tricky waters. But also, he lives by the same... He's still a warlord. He's still, like... Yes. He's still a lord who has to murder people on the regular. So, like, I don't know if I want to follow this guy. I'm torn on everybody like that, and especially Buntaro.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of, I guess, the definition of a good military commander, someone who is not, you know, wasteful with spending lives, but someone who sure. is not, can make those difficult decisions of, like, throwing Blackthorn to the Portuguese and the the Japanese lords and I guess hoping he can figure out a way.
Or being okay if he can't and just sacrificing him, you know, for the larger mission like they talk about.
Same thing with Buntaro that, you know, and that guy volunteered for that and it's not like, but I don't know. I think it's really neat. And also, or I guess it just shows his qualities. Like, I don't necessarily think he's a bad guy. But yeah, it's one of those things where can Blackthorn trust him? And to what extent, you know, that's the thing. Because, and also I'm still kind of debating in my mind, like, what is the most important thing to Torunaga? Is this all, out of respect for his dead lord and trying to save his son? Is this more of like, you know, he's always had this ambition, he's just kind of biding his time, or it's one of those things where it's like he didn't really want to do this, but if it's the choice between turning the keys of Japan over to these four idiots, they're going to murder his lord's son and me taking control, then I guess I'll take control. I'm really curious because they keep telling me that he is hiding his true heart and no one knows, not even his son.
And that's what, to me, says don't ever trust this guy. Don't ever think you're this guy's friend. And that's the thing that's happening over the course of this episode is I think Blackthorn doesn't realize that. Blackthorn is a guy who, I know he's a pirate, but he also doesn't have the same values, the same cultural like touchstones.
Right.
And the Torunaga is not a guy you can befriend. He will never be your friend. Because he's not playing a game of friends and enemies. He's playing a game of me.
Yes.
You are the only person you can trust, even to his son. And that's like...
That's wild.
Right. That to us is like the weird thing, right? And it may be even to the Japanese, I assume. But like... I don't know. Everything I've seen from the Japanese media has told me that there is like a tinge of... If the son doesn't prove themselves, they're kind of nothing. And if they even like slightly disgrace the family, they get disowned and shit. And I'm like, oh boy. Don't play this game with him. I feel like Blackthorn is falling into that trap. He starts to get a little bit of what he views as respect, and he gets in a swimming race with this guy. And now I'm worried that he's suddenly going to think he's Torunaga's friend and start acting like it when Torunaga will not.
And do you think there's like, I'm trying to also, because that's yes, even by I think Japanese standards of kind of like reserve and holding your different interior hearts, like he is, because of his the way he was brought up, because of his hostage the childhood, that he's got this like extremely warped view of loyalties. And I'm wondering if like his arc is going to be like maybe where he can extend some of this loyalty and he can find people he can truly trust, or is it going to be something where like Blackthorn has to learn that no, Torunaga really is like, I mean, broadly speaking, Torunaga might be doing within his own mind what he thinks is best for Japan, but at no time I think does Torunaga think about any other being in that equation other than himself. Like I said, he might be trying to work for the common good, but individually for his men and the people to follow him, for his vassals, that doesn't mean that you're going to win, you personally, as Buntaro found out this episode.
I don't know. That's super interesting going forward. It's probably the most interesting thing that I'm keeping my eye on.
Yeah. And I also continue to be surprised at how funny this show is. Like, I thought Blackthorne's distraction at the gate is absolutely hilarious. I love the race with him and the Spaniard hurling insults at each other.
Sure.
There's a lot of humor, and I think a lot of prestige shows kind of miss that. You know, they don't quite get that mix. They just become dour affairs, and this has got like full spectrum humanity in it, man, all the time.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move. All right, well, I am really itching to talk about this episode. Why don't we get into the recap?
Yeah, let's do that. So we open Tomorrow's Tomorrow with Yabushiga composing his last will and testament. God, it's important to keep that up to date. Bald Movers, take note. If it's been a while, get your affairs in order.
And I get the impression that he does this over breakfast, like every morning. He's like, I wonder. Yes, this is our best will to date. Well, how many wills do you write, man?
It seems like it's underlining his fixation on death, that moment of death. Like, he's always preparing for, like, and we see that kind of bears fruit. And is it the first or second episode where it's like, when it looked like he was going to die, he had his sword out and was like, nope, I'm going to, you know, like, I think they're building to, my guess is he's going to have a dramatic fucking death.
Probably, yeah.
And I'm not sure if it's going to be as a hero or a villain, but this guy is super fun to watch. And it's especially good to get your last will and testament together before you're going to meet your lord at dawn. Uh-huh. Who presumably for him to take for him to take your head for your beshitting your honor.
Yeah. Yeah. He thinks he's dying because he's connected to the assassination. And I want to ask you, how connected do you think he is to this assassination? Like, I know that he was kind of working with Ishido, but it was Kiyama that actually hired that assassin, right?
I think that, so my read, and I could be wrong because I haven't read the book and I'm so far spoiler free, my reading is Yabu is kind of playing both sides, and he's unwilling to directly betray his current lord until he has some kind of surety. And so my thing is, I think that he stole, obviously he stole the Anjin, kept him from being executed, which is what Ishido wanted. Mm-hmm. But he also returned him to Torunaga because he had no plausible way to play that any other way without showing, you know, without playing his hand. And he respects Torunaga enough that he thinks that, you know, he can't quite count him out. And I think that Torunaga here, like, his philosophy is he doesn't have friends or enemies, he has leverage.
Sure.
And by having this kind of like judgment hanging over Yabushiga's head and using that to tease out, what do you really want in your heart of hearts so I can offer it to you before Ishida would offer something like that. I think it makes them all look very smart. And but what's your read on this guy? Did he betray Toranaga last episode, this episode, the first episode?
I mean, he betrayed everyone in all episodes is my read on him. He's running right down the middle here, looking for the best deal and risking death to do it. But the thing that's interesting to me is when he is asked, what did Ishida offer you? And he says, your seat on the council. And then he says, oh, and were you tempted by that? He says, absolutely not. And I believe him.
I did too.
He understands that that seat is not a place he wants to sit.
And that he would just be a pawn in their game. Whereas also, I don't think Yabushiga really wants to be a bureaucrat. Like, it seems like he would rather have a nice, comfortable fiefdom that he can do whatever the fuck he wants with at all times. And he doesn't want to have to go to some big city and stamp shit all day. So I wonder, I think this...
Who he'd rather be the I don't know the term for, but who he'd rather be under here, Ishido or Toranaga?
Yeah,
because like sees them,
especially since we know that him and Ishido are like war buddies, and I think that Yabushiga owes him his life to some extent.
Potentially,
but
yeah,
there's something he must see in Toranaga, because we also, I mean, they haven't come right out and told us this. And that's what I love about the show is like, you can kind of like make your own judgments, but it also seemed that Yabushiga chose to follow Toranaga. Like, he was kind of in Ishido's camp. And then at some point he backed Toranaga as the horse to be his banner man.
Yeah,
for.
He must have.
So it's like, yeah, what overrode that longtime loyalty and the war buddy thing? And how is he able to do this so well? Because I don't think Ishido is a fool. I think he's pretty perceptive. He's like a notch below Toranaga in terms of cunning and craft. But how is he? Because like, was that seen as a betrayal, or is that seen as like you're making a mistake? I'm very curious to see how this plays out.
I wonder if we'll get some flashbacks to that. There's also this concept of the Society of Amida, the Amida, which are assassins, kind of embed themselves wherever. They're high-end assassins. This woman who attacked Toranaga was apparently serving as a maid in his entourage for years.
Yeah.
Just laying in wait.
The amount of expense it must cost to buy someone's life.
Yeah,
you know, like a round of ammunition.
What's the point of being that as an assassin? Because you're never going to live a life that you want. And even if you're getting paid a huge amount, you still have to live whatever life they've put you in. You can't, like, this maid can't have a lavish castle that she lives in or something, right? It doesn't matter how much money she has.
So it's my understanding, because I looked into this, that is as much of like historical roots as this show has, is this is entirely something invented for the show's fiction. But I think they did not the show for the book. Clavell invented this because it's like essentially I looked into this is like seen these are seen as religious fanatics. And like kind of like, you know, you might have certain sects do crazy things that we would see as crazy because they're promised, you know, so many virgins when they get to paradise, or they're promised, you know, eternal life or sitting in the, you know, in God's right hand if they do the thing. Like, there's this element religious fanaticism where they're obsessed with like living in such a way that they get to this Buddhist version of heaven, this like highest. So, like, I think it's just they're just religious fanatics, you know? This is their way of worshiping.
I say, look, you only know for sure that you got one life. Maybe live for that life, not the next one. But, you know, I'm not
one
a
thing
religious
I
fanatic.
Have, one thing I, because I used to be very religious, but, like, you know, I go back and, like, when I was, until I was about 30, I would consider myself extremely religious. But even then, I was religious in, like, a secular 20th century, you know, kind of way. It's very hard. This is something that I got talking to our buddy Anthony, Maester Anthony, over on the Hot D feed. He's a scholar of religion and medieval history. It's like, you cannot overstate, rather, how seriously people took religion. Like, religion wasn't something that you just do on Sunday. Religion was like your life. It was like saying that your statement of like the only thing you're sure of is this life. That was extremely fringe belief system.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of times that'd be a weird statement to make to a lot of people. A scary statement to make, that you're throwing away eternity for these momentary pleasures. So it's like, it's always important to know that, like, you know, when we're talking about like religion being real to people, it meant a completely different thing, and it means different things are all over the earth today. But like, you go back of just a few hundred years, and universally around the planet, it was serious fucking business. 99.9% of people are down. And that's how you got whole societies to fall in line and do things, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. We were to move on to the next scene.
Mm-hmm.
I did like just the, you know, you've got this like very tense scene where Yabashiga is worried that he's going to lose his head, but it also ends with this extremely beautiful scene of Lord Toranaga inviting him to watch the morning with him. Because I don't know that everyone in his room knows it, but like, this might be their last one.
Yep.
So we have a brief scene of the Father Visitor and Father Martine trying to press upon the Captain General of the Black Ship the dangers of ignoring the Japanese protocols in terms of leaving and staying at harbors. But he says, fuck all this. I work for the Crown, not for your church, and I am leaving tonight with the breeze.
Yeah, and he tells Rodriguez this, and Rodriguez is like, whoa, man, we're gonna get banned. This is our job. This is our livelihood. You're gonna get us banned from Japan. It makes me question exactly what the Crown has in store here, because one thing he notably says is that he has to have this million ducats or whatever he's got on his ship in Macau. That's where his shipment is headed. And that, to me, if you were paying attention in the first two episodes, Macau is the place where the Ronin or whatever have been staged. These rogue samurai who are not living by the code anymore. So that is interesting. Maybe the Crown has some plans that are going to unfurl pretty soon.
Or if these Ronin are bought purely, it seems like they're kind of fanatical Christians too, but it also, I'm sure being mercenaries, being paid doesn't hurt. I wonder what happens if this vast sum of money doesn't make it to that island, or that port, that fortress.
Yeah. No, it's I'm sure that's what they're hinting at here. With the name check of Macau.
And also the thing is like, I don't know how widespread this knowledge is, but, you know, back in the age of sail, leaving at certain times is really fucking important because you needed the wind to take you places. And as the seasons change, sometimes the wind stops, sometimes the wind reverses, and it's quite frankly impossible to get to a place for a month, 2 months, 3 months sometimes. Have you missed a tide?
Yeah, and it can take four times as long, right? Like,
I mean, that's how, if you recall, this season started with Blackthorn bitching and moaning about how the Dutch captain refused to wait until it was almost too late and then the wind set against them, and that's why they almost didn't survive that crossing. They ran out of food, they ran out of water. So it's extremely important to sailors to be punctual about this stuff. Because it's not like you can just fire, just wait till tomorrow, you fire up the engine, take it. No, you are a slave to the wind.
It's like a farmer, you know, and you got to get your crops in the ground when you need to have them in the ground, not when you feel like it.
Right. The sun, the water, the rain, the animals, they don't wait. They don't observe daylight savings time. So then we have Blackthorn back in Osaka, the castle. He's having his injuries treated by a warlock as he and Mariko discuss the benefits of sexual healing. They're interrupted by Mariko's husband, Bantaro, as he says they're all going to be leaving Osaka in a very gruff fashion.
Yeah, this guy might be a great warrior. He's a really bad husband and father. I'm so torn on this guy because of scenes like this.
there's got to be. I wonder what the backstory is here, because she was widowed, correct?
This is her second husband, yeah. That
gets married and
potentially has been widowed a second time by the end of this episode.
Right, and you know, like, it doesn't seem like either one of them are thrilled. You can, like, I wonder what Bentaro thinks about Christianity.
Sure.
And if he's got a dim view of it, he's probably doesn't super like that. Mariko's probably bringing up their boy, at least, you know, with half his foot in that world. And maybe, I don't know. There's like, also, it seems like maybe Mariko comes from like a higher order, like of nobility than him. And there might be a little bit of insecurity there as well. Although I can't imagine why, because again, but I was expecting Bentaro to be kind of like all bark, no bite. But the dude seems like he's got the stuff, man. He's extremely brave and proficient with the blade.
Yeah. He was the biggest badass of this episode, without a doubt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's got like half the season's body count all by himself in this just like 5 minute scene. I thought this is interesting that like Blackthorn is kind of amused, but also in disbelief about how naive Mariko is about the church and its activities. She's kind of like Father Martin and like Father Domingo before them, where, you know, they read the Bible and took it seriously. And it's offensive. It's offensive, the perversion of Christianity that the Portuguese monks are putting on here. But she's just not willing and ready to see it yet.
Right.
Also, there's a hint that the Japanese of the 16th, I guess this would be the 17th century, fundamentally see sex and sexual relations different than Europeans.
Yeah. Which I don't know how accurate that is, but
yeah,
there's stuff later that also kind of leans into that, like the escape scene where he's protesting because like, oh, leering at women is improper, and he's like, buddy, this is Japan, get out of my way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know, like, there's probably different rules for how high or low on the social ladder you are and whatnot, but I mean, you're right, I don't know about the historicity of all this, but I feel like I'd see a lot of ink spilt if this was fundamentally wrong. But it's not just like the, you know, at least among the lords, it's not so much the casual sex kind of blowing off steam, but the fact that, like, same-sex relationships don't seem to be nearly as stigmatized. Or if it's seen as like unsavory, it's certainly not forbidden because they have male prostitutes on call.
And the only thing I know of this culture is from the media I've seen. I've not read historical accounts or, you know, even books written by historians or anything. But that's what I've seen from the Japanese. That's how I've seen it portrayed in all of the, let's say, ancient Japanese history stuff that I've seen in the television shows. Is it's a lot more flexible. Those rules aren't quite as rigid, and those, I guess, not rules but expectations. And it's just more about the pleasure that you derive from it is not judged as harshly, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you're supposed to get from the scene is like if you compare 17th century European like medical technology and advances, they were actually lagging quite a bit behind traditional Eastern medicine at this point, where they had a much better understanding of like what herbs and medicine could do and had a little bit more rigorous approach to it rather than leeching and saying, oh, because this thing stinks, it must be spreading disease. And there was just a, you know, like a touch ahead of the technology and research tree as Europe.
I guess I wasn't getting that. The thing I was getting from this is Blackthorn doesn't know a doctor from his own asshole. Like,
this is also true.
He like is a pirate, right? He went to the sea because he was seeking freedom. He's not a guy who gets regular checkups. So I don't know how much I judge all of European medicine by Blackthorn's take on Eastern medicine.
That's true. And like Europe's a big country big continent. So judging England by and Spain and France and Italy all together is probably a mistake.
Sure.
We have another brief scene where the Iron Fist, Hiramatsu, presents Fuji, his granddaughter, her husband and her baby son's cremains. Then he talks about their family. Yep. He then talks a little bit about their family history and lays a heavy burden upon her.
Honestly,
uh-huh.
This guy was a pretty big guy. I expected a bigger box. Like, that baby box is only about two-thirds the size of his box. He was at least five times bigger than that baby.
And they probably make those custom, right? They don't have, you don't go, you don't go to like the cremains box store for like a high ranking samurai.
Give me my seppuku box and it's going to be factory made? No chance, man.
That's going to have all that crazy, intricate Japanese wood joinery. It's not going to any nails use. Everything fits together like a Rubik's
Cube. Dovetails galore, man.
So, I don't know. Maybe the guy was high moisture content. Got all that out of there. Just so nothing,
once they drained him,
left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one wet baby, apparently.
What did you think? Because, like, I guess, what did you think was happening when you first saw this? And, like, and now after the benefit of a couple watches, what is your understanding about what he's telling her to do? And is this fulfilled in this episode? Or?
I guess he's pitching her on the plan. I don't know. It's tough to say because she... She isn't really someone who needs to know for this plan, right? She's not the one faking. So the only people who have to know about this plan are, is it Lady Ochiba? Is that her name? It's the woman in the box, that's... right?
Okay, so like Lady Ochiba, I believe
Hiramatsu's wife
is it? Because I thought we had misunderstood this. I thought that the older lady is Torunaga's first wife, and like eldest wife, and Ochiba is like his consort, who is currently pregnant with his child. So Torunaga has many.
Okay, all right,
or at least two.
Well, then both of them need to know. Right? Because they're the ones executing the plan. And those are the only people who actually need to know this plan.
Yeah. And Torunaga literally is playing the people, literally the people that needed to pull it off. So Iron Fist, and Fuji and the wife.
Does he need to know? Why does Hiramatsu need to know?
Only because he is the one who kind of smoothed over to Sun wanting to chest up to Ishido's men and saying, oh, no, it's you can inspect the leader. And then him meeting with the women and saying everything worked fine. It's in God's hands now.
Oh, yeah.
I think, yeah.
They do have
but
that
like,
scene.
But so Torunaga's son doesn't get brought into it because honestly, him being ignorant is the best defense because they can genuinely, you don't have to worry about anyone acting. They just do what they do.
Yeah, same with like Yabushige and all of his guys, and none of them need to know.
And the other thing is like we see how handy Mariko is with the Naginata. If you've seen Blue Eyed Samurai, you know that that's essentially the Japanese version of like a halberd, where it's like a short katana mounted to a bow staff, you know. And as I saw those women, and this will be later in the episode, just like, you know, spring into action and start fighting, I started wondering, I was like, this is very cool, but I wonder how historical it is to have like these noble women just picking up these swords and mowing down samurai. And apparently this is extremely historical. Like this is the point of Japanese history will start to fade by the wayside. But they call them the Anamusha. I'm probably butchering that. But they these are female warriors. They were often highborn ladies, and they were trained to defend their families and accomplish missions for their lords. They were especially accomplished with those. I was just on the tip of my tongue that. Naginatas. They're especially proficient with those, and sometimes there was entire divisions of warriors that were all women in this era and leading up this era Japan. So I thought maybe he's actually saying that bringing her into the conspiracy because, like, you know, there won't be that many people that know, and we'll need every sword on her side. And I bet the Iron Fist granddaughter was taught well in the ways of the martial arts. So I think he's kind of directly saying you are, and I guess that was part of the samurai's whole thing, is that a samurai's wife would essentially be expected to do everything that the Sam are like, anything that you're asked to do in terms of defense of the Lord or defense of the family, keeping confidences and going to war, that's something you did. So I kind of think he's directly like saying it's your time for you to step up, kid.
I mean, yeah, he doesn't. This is not all about her husband killing himself, right? I mean, there's a double edge to this sword, or not, that's not the right term, but there's a dual meaning here.
Yeah,
for sure. Because yeah, he could be talking about this guy. You know, he was doing his greater duty as a Japanese citizen to uphold our customs and whatnot, and maintain your honor. But he's also saying, hey, I got a big ask of you. Do it for the country. Do it for your people.
And it is in context of dying in a greater struggle. So you can also see kind of like, I feel like almost a fatalism creeping in, where like she's weeping because she's clearly unhappy with, I don't know why she's unhappy, honestly, because she just wanted to kill herself to be with her family the last episode, and now she's being granted a chance to die honorably in the service of her Lord. And
well, she has no purpose. They were talking all about that purpose, right? Like, I will give you your purpose back, that kind of thing. And her purpose probably would have been to die with her family, but that was taken from her. Now Hiramatsu is giving her a new purpose, but I don't think we know what that is yet, because she doesn't have any actual role to play in this escape attempt.
She does. She does join Mariko in defense of the convoy. Like, she gets her staff out and starts mowing down dudes too. I noticed that on a second watch.
Yeah, but that doesn't require Hiramatsu to step in and say, you know, when people attack you, defend yourself.
I know that, but I think that's what I'm saying. So. I think she is one of the ones being brought into the confidence here, is what this scene's telling me.
Yes, but to what end? Like, I totally agree with that. I'm just not sure we've seen her actual role in this yet. But we'll see.
She understands it, and it's something she weeps over. Yabushiga prepares his men to escort Torunaga's wife, Fuji, as well as the Anjin, the pilot, Blackthorn, out of the city to his fishing village. Unfortunately, Ishido, wary of some form of trickery, comes to inspect the caravan before they leave. And, man, these are some tense scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
First off, I gotta say, I love Yabushige's hairy helmet.
It's so good.
I don't know if that's supposed to be emulating a lion, but looks like a lion with a ponytail kind of thing. But man, maybe it's a dragon. I don't know. Dragons have more hair.
I was thinking maybe like one of those Asian inspired Eastern looking dragons. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking with our mutual friend, Jesse, who has a degree in history. We were talking just in casual while we're playing Helldivers, how kind of crazy it is that feudal Japan developed an almost entirely parallel structure in completely independent from feudal Europe.
Like, they had like, for what?
I'm talking like mounted knights with full suits of armor that had, you know, swords and lances and bows, and they had a form of chivalry called Bushido, which governed their actions and the way they even organized. I mean, maybe it's like a feudal society just suggests a certain type of structure and certain kind of technological developments. Like, if you have horses and steel, then you develop knights. If you don't, you develop something else. But I just think it's really crazy that these samurai are the same thing as medieval knights. They're just separated by two whole continents in a few hundred years. But I just think it's just like how biologists are fascinated how often nature has independently evolved a crab. Like, there's like six different types of crabs out there, and they all came from a completely independent species, and they call it carcinization, I think, is like the tendency for certain things to evolve into crabs. Like, it's wild that it's like, hey, I got horses and steel. You know what? Knights. That's what we'll have. We'll have knights.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to say there's something fundamental about human nature that causes that, but then I look at some other
arms race
populations
too.
And it's not that way. So I don't know.
It might just be an arms race. Like, if you have it given that you will have blunt and sharp-edged weapons as well as arrows that can, you know, penetrate people's bodies from 100 yards away. You'll just come up with ways to complete, you know, you're just going to keep up armoring and keep on getting better weapons until you come up with the equilibrium, and it looks like kind of full plate armor.
Yeah, it's basically a physics question at that point.
But it's so good. Like, I mean, this shit is just exquisite. It's just fan. I don't know. There's something like Stark and I guess Cybertrucky about European armor suits.
Yeah, it wasn't designed with beauty in mind, whereas this is. I mean, certainly almost honoring the warrior.
Yeah, you see like filigrees and whatnot. But sure. Like, sure. It's not like you don't get ornamental armor in Europe, but this is
typically
like,
that isn't used very much either, right? Like the ornamental armor will be something that people have commissioned because they're fancy kings or lords or whatever, and it sits on the rack and they never get it down. Yeah, These guys, I take it, commissioned their suit to fight in, and then when they weren't fighting, they put it up on the rack.
Yeah. No, it's just exquisite. It's beautiful. The craftsmanship, the colors, how rich it looks. The hairy helmets. It's all just amazing. The little half moon shapes they have on everything. It's just super cool.
They do some really good work in this scene with Ishido telling us his suspicions here without really telling us, because he's leaning on protocol here. You know, we agreed upon a proper protocol that I would be alerted a day before any lords or their whoever's left the castle. And so he comes in here under those auspices. But then the entire time he's doing this inspection, you can see him like physically bracing for an attack. He's crouched like as they open the second box, and he's just waiting for Torunaga to pop out and attack, right?
And how Torunaga is so next level that he anticipated that and made sure that he swapped out after everything had been checked. And
He delayed long enough for Ishido to show up because he has control of this place, and he knows that if he gets outside of his own courtyard here, he won't be able to make the swap.
Right. I didn't even pick up on that, but yeah, the fact that, like, you know, you can see Yabushiga getting impatient, knowing that, like, oh my god, why the fuck is this taking so long? Because we're going
to stop us.
They're going to stop us, and that's what happens. And I think it's also really funny or neat that Blackthorn picks it up, and I guess it's because he doesn't understand the distraction. So, like, you know, all the Japanese understand this woman's pregnant and she's going into pre-labor, their eyes kind of fix over there. He's just like, I don't know, some people are shouting, whatever, and his eyes are kind of wandering, and he sees through the sleight of hand and sees Torunaga sliding into that litter. What did you think of giving us... I wondered about whether it was wise to give the kind of wink at the audience and give us a little bit of the know that toward the Torunaga switch had happened. Would that be better? If the scene at the gate doesn't work as well if we and Blackthorn aren't.
And maybe in retrospect, we would have been like, oh, Blackthorn knew. They would have to tell us that some other way, though. Yeah. But because otherwise it just seems like he's trying to defend the honor of these women, and I don't think Blackthorn is that kind of guy.
Yeah. I also really like how Iron Hands, even though he's not as good a diplomat as his lord and he's not as perceptive, he is very good at playing these parts where, you know, Torunaga's son gets to be hot-headed and he's like, I ain't letting no fucking greys inspect our shit, and, you know, he's about ready to die for it. And he comes out like, oh, no, this is not, it's all misunderstanding, of course, and just smooths it all over. I like him. I like him a lot. And it's like all of the official cover that they have, you know, it's like, it's not that these guys are hostages. I just, you know, just who wants to not pay respects to the Lady Kiri, you know?
Right.
And then Lady Kiri's like, she's caught like leaving, breaking protocol. It's like, well, you know, you heard about the attack. There's just too many bandits in this city, and how that keeps being like the Christian lords where, you know, they're trying to like plausible deniability. Is like, the Forester just teamed with bandits all lately. I don't know what to say. It's kind of embarrassing. Just like all this face saving Where they everyone knows they're being lied to, and they know that there's some kind of okie doke here, but it's all stuff you have to dig for. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's complex. It's rich. I like the scene later that we'll get to with Ishido and Kiyama, where he's like, "Man, you really are throwing a monkey wrench in my plans here." Like, because he gave him that cover, right? That assassination attempt is like, how can I tell these people they have to stay here or convince these people to stay here if there are assassins attacking them every other day? So
I also wonder what happens to Lady Kiri and Ochiba now that.
Right.
It's like, are their lives forfeit? Are they going to be officially arrested and held hostage now? Does the other lords just execute them in revenge?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. There are, like I said about Blackthorn, I think there are sacrifices that Torunaga is willing to make, and I do think the Lady Kiri here is in serious trouble if she's found inside the castle.
Yeah.
Now that she's supposed to have gone. Although, so they know. So, like, they find out over the course of this that she wasn't actually in that cart. So, like,
they would have to.
Are they going to be seeking her out next episode? Use her as a hostage? I mean,
I wonder, and that's the thing. It's like, if anything protects her, it's got to be because Torunaga's got another plan. Like, he had a way to spirit them out and, like, why they're focused on him. Or he's counting on Protocol to save her. But, like, man, Protocol is just that. There's nothing. It's not a fundamental law of the universe.
I mean, Kiyama breaks it this episode, right? I mean, he's trying to assassinate,
but it's plausible that those are just bandits. Those weren't his men.
Oh, of course, you know? Yeah. But also he's attacking, you know, the pilot, the heretic. It's not like he meant to attack Torunaga. So,
but he also gave no fucks about Ishido's men getting in the way too. Kiyama, like, and it's like, oh, Lord Ishido's men down there. It's like, oh, I guess they'll die along with the heretic. So it's like, it's very much, protocol and politeness and rules govern the society, but also to a certain extent, you know, because might makes right at the end of the day. And it's like, who's going to go to the mattresses first, I guess. There's also a scene, this is kind of like in the same scene. It's a transition to the next one. The Inspector General, I don't know what his name is, but he's the guy who is going through and opening all the litters. Ask Yuba about his apparent duplicity, and Yubashiga essentially says, I have to follow my lord, I was just keeping up appearances, but just, you know, just tell Ishido that I know my promises and how to keep them. Is this just him keeping up appearances, or is this him still keeping the game alive, trying to keep his hands on both rungs of the chaos ladder until he knows which one's stronger?
I think it's that.
Like, he has to physically commit to a course of action he's not going to.
Yeah. And he's all other things being equal, he's going to follow the protocol, the public protocol, right? Which is, this is my lord.
Sure.
And I must obey his commands. And
even Ishido understands.
I will, but when I get a chance to betray him, I'll do that too.
And even Ishido understands that I can't openly defy my lord. I mean, I'm no good to him dead. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then how could I serve you as someone who dishonored themselves by betraying their own lord? You know, it just wouldn't work out for anybody. So
if you'd have told me going into this that, like, by the third episode, what's essentially Ramsay Bolton has become one of my favorite character, I would have been the fuck out of here. But
Yeah.
Other than the whole boiling the dude alive thing, Yubashiga is a really fun guy. Yeah,
he's an interesting character. Yeah,
yeah. So Mariko explains to Blackthorn on their way to the main gates of Osaka that her lord Torunaga can be tricksy and false, and he is forced to improvise a ridiculous distraction to avoid giving the switcheroo away. Because it turns out there's a second round of inspections.
I don't know about scenes like this, man. They never quite work for me because I know, unless they get really tricky, I know the inevitable outcome. They're not going to discover the thing that they can't discover, or else everybody's dead. They also make the antagonist look pretty dumb. if they're done ham-handedly, and I think this is a little over the top, because like something is clearly up here. You don't have somebody freak out and protest, you cannot do the thing that you're about to do, unless they really don't want you to do the thing for a good reason. And to,
the thing
to,
is,
I, look, yeah, I know ahead. He's an outsider. They don't understand any of his culture. He might just be a fanatic. But this should give you pause. If you're a Shido, this should give you pause. I know he's not here, but his men are, and they should be looking at this going, this is the second wild distraction that we've had today. Something is up here. Let's just double check and do the thing we were going to do to verify that all this is still on the up and up. It always makes them look a little dumb.
I think what works for me is the fact that Blackthorn is essentially an alien. He is a completely unknown being that all of these dudes who are just soldiers know that he is high interest of the Lord. Some of them want him live, some of them want him dead. Also Torunaga. Like, I don't know, like, to what extent they understand the politics of the situation. And the fact that, crucially, the thing that makes it work for me is Ishido. Like, these guys are just doing the general order that Ishido's got the whole city. Anything going out of the gates needs to be inspected. Mm-hmm. Not knowing that Ishido himself has already pre-inspected this. So, like, I think even Ishido's men are a little impatient at this whole process because, like, we're competent men and we've watched this thing the whole time. So Blackthorn just putting up, but I did wonder, what is the fallback plan? Everybody, I mean, clearly Torunaga's got his armor on underneath the ladies' clothes. So is it just to like surprise, overwhelm and kill everybody and then just fight their way out of the city or what? Cause like, it did seem that protocol was going to let these guys get themselves fucking killed because Blackthorn's the only one making the sink.
Yeah. It's hugely risky. And they just took their swing, and I think it was about to fail if Blackthorn doesn't step in.
I just think the Blackthorn also just going fully committing to it, where, you know, he's like, peering into women's private quarters, it's not proper, it's vulgar, it's an unholy perversion. And then the guy belts him to the ground, and he grabs onto his foot, and he's screaming, my God, the shame of it! My God, the shame of it. I would like to just bellow that in public every once in a while. I'm gonna try that at King's Island a few times when I see some bad behavior. See if it cows anyone. You, sir, are a silly little man.
The next time I'm asked to tip for a takeout order. My God, the shame of it.
Yeah. Next time I'm asked to round up for a charity and I'll pay a suggested 30% tip to the guy who just made my sandwich. It's vulgar. And it's, I also think it's funny that like Mariko's husband, Buntaro, is like, even though Blackthorn is being very clever and saving his lord's life, he's like rolling his eyes like, Jesus, I cannot believe we're risking our lives for this jackass.
It's a good
1-2 punch.
Honestly, nobody else steps in here because, yeah, the protocol and the honor. Like, they're not gonna roll around in the mud and try and prevent death because they don't view it the same way.
The other thing I really like about the visual and sound of this is, like, they do this really cool thing that they'll do a lot throughout this episode where they show, like, a bird's eye view of, like, the maze-like aspects of the city streets and the murking. And they also, I've noticed this ever since Dunkirk, like, you know, Nolan had that kind of like ticking stopwatch kind of soundtrack where you have that. I noticed that they use that a lot in late season Expanse, like that just kind of, you know, they have other themes, but underneath it all is like a metronome. They did it in this scene. Just it's like that. Plus they threw in these kind of rising, almost shepherd tones that just really ramped up the tension from here to the forest fight. That's always just that ticking little stopwatch sound. I think it's a great way to build tension. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move. So they made it outside the city and it's nighttime and they're all walking through with this caravan, and Mariko and Blackthorn discuss their families before discussion is cut short by a surprise attack. It seems the Christian Lord Kiyama has ambushed them in another attempt to gain control over the engine, the pilot.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that Kiyama... I think he was willing to kill Toranaga's family and entourage and everybody here. You know, not directly. He's got the guise of faux bandits. But he's willing to murder Toranaga's family.
I think he's going to murder everyone. Like, the idea of this was no survivors.
Yeah. I mean, I know they're all thinking, well, Toranaga will be dead soon anyway, but if that ever comes out, it's a dangerous thing.
It's true, but I guess they're... everyone just... this is, like, I feel like the epitome of counting your chickens before they've hatched. Like, these lords are planning as if Toranaga has already been beheaded and he's dead. Yeah. And they're acting in that way. But crucially, Toranaga is not dead. But yeah, like, if they're worried at all about his reprisal, they would not be... Because they don't know that he is in that litter, but they think that he's... They're murdering his majordomo's granddaughter and his first wife.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty serious.
They talk about the Japanese view of sexual health. I love the archaic words for prostitutes. Foul slatterns and trollops everywhere. The moment of clouds and rains, that was good. And also, again, they're sending this Bentaro to be this, like, wet blanket, you know, just, you know, is this guy actually good at anything other than bullying women and children?
It's the thing, they really want you to be conflicted on him by the end of this episode, and it worked for me. I'm simultaneously impressed at the how good of a warrior he is, but also how awful of a family man he is.
Yeah, and I wonder what more there is to this and how much we'll learn of it. But yeah, everyone's, you know, got different mixes of light and dark, and this guy's got a lot to recommend him. Also, I is this significant? I looked up because, you know, he has a nickname, right? Like Iron Fist.
I tried to find what Bentaro means.
I found it. Iron Fist mm-hmm. is like, that's a pretty badass nickname, and you think that guy must kick ass and fight. Buntaro means bright and cheerful. It's like a nickname okay. for a boy, and it's like, this is not how I describe him at all. So I wonder if this is a clue yeah. that this guy actually, like, him and Mariko had things in common where, like, neither one of them wanted to be in this, and they're kind of forced together, and they're both kind of resentful about it.
Maybe. It could be one of those things where it's an ironic nickname, right?
It could be that, too. It yeah. could be that, too. These Japanese lords don't strike me as, like, Gen X ironic, but maybe they are. Maybe they are.
Yeah. I don't know. They say his friends call him that, so...
Were you surprised to find Blackthorn with a full-ass family?
Here's the thing. I don't give a shit. I don't care about Blackthorn's family and how good of a dad he is. He's a pirate. I know he's a piece of shit.
He's a privateer, Jim. There's a difference.
He's a pirate. He's off with his head, man. That's the thing. I just don't care about Blackthorn's sob story. Like, oh, I'm a bad dad. Boo-hoo. I have so much
you
regret.
Say that.
Who gives a shit?
I don't think
read that was
in
his performance. Yeah, he feels bad about it.
I mean, I can make value judgments of how much importance he puts on freedom at the ocean versus being there to be a good dad, but I don't know if he's
sure.
a bad dad.
I mean, okay, I don't know. There's a distinction without a difference there, maybe for me, but like, yeah, I just don't care. I just don't care about Blackthorn's family.
I guess I don't care about the family too. I'm more of like, what does it tell me about him and his, you know, interest? And clearly, I was suspicious of it before, but I'm almost certain that they're building towards some kind of romance with Mariko yeah. and him, and like Buntaro
the husband
being
out of the way, and yeah,
yeah, getting exit stage left. That there seemed like they're opening that up. So anyway, they attack with flaming arrows. Buntaro gets to show off his Legolas skill. He's getting hit in the guys with long range arrows. Toranaga is forced to reveal himself when his litter catches on fire. And then it's on, because it's now this three way fight between Ishido's men trying to escape and warn Ishido, and also kill or contain Toranaga, and also not get killed by the Christian lords. And it's just a real, real shit show.
Yeah, feels like a free for all. Is like the enemy already within the fighting lines, the battle lines of the good guys here. It's crazy. You got flaming arrows flying everywhere. Here's the thing I don't understand. Speaking of the soundtrack, there is one singular rifle shot that goes off during this battle, and I do not understand the purpose of that.
Why?
What does it mean? Everybody takes note of it. Everybody's like, oh, a rifle shot. And then nothing.
Was it the signal to start the battle?
I guess it could have been. Couldn't you just yell? I don't know.
I'm not even sure. This didn't register with me. The fact that there was a single rifle shot. Yeah. To kick things off.
Yeah. Maybe if anybody knows, they can write in and let us know.
Yeah, that would be shogun@baldmove.com. We already talked about the women here, Mariko and Fuji, just going to work with their naginatas and cutting these men down. And also Yabu ironically observing to Toranaga. It's like, I wish just once I'd know about your plan before they're actually happening. And also, yeah, Toranaga probably wishes he could count on all of his men not to actively betray him. But we don't always get what we want.
Yeah.
So Buntaro also cements his badass stat by volunteering to lead a detachment of men to fight a rearguard action to allow Toranaga and the rest to escape. Meanwhile, two different dispatches go to the harbor to warn Ishido to prepare for the coming of the Englishman.
Yeah, this is... Is this the scene where he fights his way down to the pier and then...
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. So Toranaga and his band tries to make it out of the harbor as quickly as they can, while his men, led by Buntaro, bravely hold off the combined forces of Ishido and Kiyama. But just when it looks like they've made it, they see a screening force of fishing vessels waiting to ambush them before they can make it to open sea.
So I really love Buntaro's fight scene here. I think it's some of the best action work that the show has done. It really showcases him as a badass. But the thing I love about it the most is that this, it's not fancy flourishes and shit. And we've talked about, you know, how the samurai method of fighting is much more decisive. But this feels almost like a sword brawl. Like, this is 40 guys against one, and he's kind of just swinging wildly, but he's trained a lot better than these other people who are swinging wildly, and so his strikes land and theirs don't. And there's nothing like fancy about it. It feels like you're fighting in the mud with somebody, and he just, he comes across looking at like a badass here fighting 40 people.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, because I follow a lot of guys that do HEMA, which is historical European martial arts reenacting, where they go, because like you, what you said is like the samurai form of sword combat's different than, it's not really, it's just that we're comparing very realistic samurai combat with Hollywood sword fights.
Sure. Yeah.
No sword fight in history, like, unless you're talking about literally a duel, no battlefield probably a sword fight ever went on more than probably three passes before somebody was dead, right? Because you're hacking at people with a meter long piece of steel that's sharp and weighs about 3 pounds, and if it hits something unarmored, it's going to fuck you up. And also, so everybody's a buzz at like how accurate this combat was, and also the other thing that really gets up these guys' ass is depiction of like armor not working. Like, how many times in Game of Thrones have you seen a dude without a helmet roll up to a dude in full plate armor, just stab him right through the breastplate, or slice his throat, sure, or slice across his back, and the guy's like, ah, it's like, why the fuck are you wearing a quarter inch steel? Like, that's not, and Bantaro is like tanking hits. He's essentially fighting a bunch of unarmored dudes with swords, and he is like, you know, using his armor to like strategically take blows and then, you know, return them, and those guys are just wearing kimonos, so they're getting cut like wheat. It's a really good scene, and it's you don't have to have these. There's a time and place for Princess Bride style 5 minute long character building. You know, I love Darth and Luke, all the fights they had, but also you don't need that for it to be exciting and for there to be stakes. And I think this scene really showcases that.
Here's the other thing about this scene: we don't see Buntaro die. He runs down an alley, still swinging, still fighting, still kicking.
Yeah.
What are the odds he shows back up?
High. Because the only thing more dramatic to have a double widow fall in love with an Englishman is for the double widow to fall in love with the Englishman. And then her very noble, returns. Very brave, very dutiful, but also asshole husband shows back up. And what's she going to do?
Yep.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we talk about this in Bald Move all the fucking time. You don't see someone die on screen, you at least medium suspect that they're going to be coming back.
Yeah. Unless their corpse has been burnt, they're probably not dead yet.
Yeah. And there are exceptions where this isn't true. Like, I think even when you talk, it's like, you know, like if the story tells us definitively the person's dead and it's a PG movie and they can't show a violent death, then, but this is not shy about it. They wanted to show this guy pincushioned and really twist the knife in Mariko's gut as they're twisting it in Bentaro's. They absolutely would have done that. And I thought it was interesting, first of all, like, you know, the way they fight this, where he's just too late. If he got there 10 seconds ago, he could have been saved, but he's in full armor. They can't stop. He probably can't. If he could swim, he can't swim in full armor. So that moment of respect between, you know, Toranaga and him, and how like meaningful that is to everyone. Like, Mariko looks extremely conflicted. What do you think is up with that?
Even the guys up on the ridge are like, they stop rushing him, you know, and maybe because they just saw 15 dudes murdered and they're scared, but also
that too, they're waiting for backup and archers and
yeah, could be, but also they could just be giving him his moment to claim his honor before they murder him, right? Like,
yeah.
And I don't know if there's a expectation here that he's supposed to kill himself, and he asks, like, what he's doing is asking his lord for permission to do that, and Toranaga doesn't give it, or if what he's doing is simply saying, I have fought bravely for you, please recognize that.
Yeah, witness me.
so that I can feel honored in this moment before I die. And Torunaga does do that. Did you ever read on that?
It's wild, because like I did see something where someone said that in the book and the previous episode where Yabashiga climbs down that cliff to rescue the Rodriguez, right? Or is mm-hmm. it Ramirez? It's Rodriguez.
Rodriguez.
That in the book, like I guess one, if not two of his men, as he's struggling in the water, just jump off the cliff to their death and like Jesus. Essentially scream, "Witness me." As like Senpai. Just to kind of like just so their master can see like how much they love him and how they I can't do anything to help you, but
Jesus,
and like just for the honor and yeah. like again they believe in the afterlife, so that
right.
means
right.
something. And I think there's a little you might be right, because like I thought that too when he kneeled down. I'm like, oh, he's going to, as soon as the bowing is over, he's just going to disavow himself,
right? And so maybe Torunaga doesn't give him permission in this moment to do it.
Yeah. It's more of a revenge mission, and it's not shameful to die. I honestly don't know all the ins and outs of Bushido.
Yeah, because not giving him permission would be a pretty big dishonor, right? Like if he requests like permission, that would be a shameful thing to do to somebody after they've defended you this way.
I think Torunaga's capable of it, but yes. Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, you can't do the honorable thing because it's going to fuck me over. So do the, but.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's kind of what he did to Fuji, right? The honorable thing was for her to join her family in death, but he ordered her not to live with the shame for some other greater
purpose. That Hiramatsu's entire family line wouldn't be ended here. Yeah. How does Mariko feel about this? I'm looking at her face and I'm looking at her demeanor and I'm saying, I think she's very conflicted.
I think it's because they don't love each other and they're in this marriage of like convenience and probably a marriage just to consolidate Torunaga's power. But also, he might be a giant asshole, but he's still the father of her children and he goes out like such a fucking G. How could you, like, if anything, feel more guilty? Like, you know, could I have been a little bit more meek and submissive? Maybe I should have treated him and made my son a skosh harder, pump the brakes on the Christian stuff, because my God, this guy just puts on a Bushido clinic of everything it means to be a man, you know, as far as a samurai. So there's got to be some mixed feelings about that, right?
Yeah, no, and I pair this with the scene later where they're talking about the Blackthorn's reasons for going to sea when he has a family at home, and his reason was, you know, the horizon more than the deep, and the freedom more than the horizon, and she that seems to strike a chord with her.
Yeah, and you wonder how many times he's come back from battles or whatever, and she's kind of like secretly thought like, God, I hope he dies. God, I hope he's dead. And now she's there to witness it, and it's not as fun as she's thinking. You know,
just entirely possible.
100%, you're right. She's conflicted.
Yeah.
So they sail out close to the black ship in the harbor, and Blackthorn, with his sharp English eyes, sees the screening, this picket line of fishing boats, who we as the audience see that they have crosses on their necks. That's bad. And they're kind of like, don't know what to do, because this is the end for them. And Blackthorn observes that they couldn't board the big giant black ship. They couldn't board and destroy it. So Torunaga requests parley for safe passage from the Portuguese ship. Let's talk about this deal he strikes.
Yeah, it seems like he's giving up something that A, is super valuable to the Portuguese priests, but also something that he must have been keeping either as leverage or something that he finds truly unacceptable, which is giving them the permission to open a church in Edo, which is, I guess, his home city.
I definitely got that's a big fucking deal. Like, Edo is one of the last bastions of none of this European Christ nonsense, and it even in the moment seems to pain Torunaga to do it.
Yeah, that's the thing. He clearly doesn't want this to happen, but it's something he needs to trade right now. It's the most valuable thing he has. I'm super interested in how this goes forward, because The Portuguese priests are just tickled pink with the thought of having a church in Edo, expanding their influence there. But at the same time, they still seem to have eyes on his demise. They say this is a promise we can hold him to even after he's dead.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that means exactly, how you hold somebody to a promise after they're dead, maybe their relatives, his son.
I assume that all the witnesses on board would probably say, oh, yeah, he definitely. Yeah. Or I wonder if they maybe got a little something in writing, too, although I think they would show that.
I would think so, yeah.
You know who they remind me, though? The other four regents in episode one. Oh, I can't believe we got Torunaga to do the things we want him to do. Yeah. And he's just putting his neck into the noose. And oh, how clever we are. Like, yeah, let's. Mm-hmm. I want to see the tune you're singing in episode five. Okay.
Yeah. No, I imagine he's going to use this as leverage, like this promise, this thing that they want that they haven't gotten yet. He'll use it as leverage at some point.
Yeah, and I was trying to think, like, why did he give up the pilot? Why did he give up Blackthorn? And is it because, surely it's not he gives a shit about the piracy thing, or he's trying to keep up appearances, because he's an outlaw from this episode on in terms of wider Japanese culture, it seems like, or politics. But it's like he just doesn't have any leverage over the Europeans. Like he'll willing to do anything to get out of this harbor, because if he doesn't, it's over. And is he hoping that... Is he hoping Blackthorn will figure out a way to survive?
If he is, he doesn't hope hard enough to assist him with that. He's just going to say, Godspeed, sir.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You stated that he's kind of an outlaw, Torunaga. Mm. Is he? I mean, all of the stuff that happened to him, I mean, people want him dead, but they've always wanted him dead. He's still operating within the structures of politics here, and everyone else also kind of has to, but they can also work behind the scenes to see his demise. All of those expectations of propriety and policy and protocol still apply, because he's not a man who's broken any laws.
Yeah,
he simply resigned from the council.
If you'll recall, I feel like about 20% of the feedback we get on any given Game of Thrones property why can't they just do this thing? Isn't it obvious that you should just do this thing? If this thing happens, you just do this thing. It's like, again, harken back to religion being a real no shit thing. And that ultimately you are a very small group of people trying to govern a nation of millions. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, even pre-democracy, your right to rule stems from the people accepting it.
Yeah.
And if the lords start playing fast and loose with the rules, well, the only thing that's letting the lords be lords is society's rules that say you've got magic blood, or the god emperor blessed you, or blah, blah, blah. So like if they if they play too fast and too loose, it might be them delegitimizing their own power. So yes, they can do anything, but if they literally do anything all the time that they want, they're going to probably face a popular uprising. So I'm not sure exactly what social norms that, because it seems ridiculous to me that Torunaga fights his way out of the harbor, blackmails and steals a bunch of shit, and then his second in command can just bop into Regent's RS the next morning and be like, oh, so sorry, but my lord is fucking off now.
Being taken hostage.
And also you can't do shit because the law says you have to have five lords, and you only got four lords. Oh, too bad. So sorry. Get in the back and learn how to count. You know,
seems
ridiculous, but
there's a certain amount of propriety they need to maintain, at least the illusion of. The people they rule over turn against them.
Also seems like this is a big time of change for Japan. Like, you know, you've got these outsiders with their outside religion, and there's already been rebellions and uprising, and there was a war with China and Korea. Like, it might be so fragile that, they want to rule Japan. They don't want to rule over a crappy, broken up, you know, balkanized version of Japan. So they're trying not, they're really trying, everyone's trying to, like, thread the needle here and get to their win condition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that the other lords are starting to realize that Ishido's win condition is essentially being shogun in all but name, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he sees this as an equal thing. or even a first among equals. Like, he sees them as like, you guys are my, you guys do my bidding. And yeah.
Yeah, and it seems like they maybe did for a while there. He was able to wrangle these other regents, but at this point they are pretty divided. And Torunaga is using the church here, or attempting to use the church and the promise of the church in Edo in order to further divide them.
So, as we mentioned, Blackthorn gets excluded from this deal. He's no longer... Torunaga goes to bat for him for a little bit, but eventually he has to give him up, and... Blackthorn does the Blackthorn thing where he just refuses to meekly accept the hand he's dealt and instead decides to race the larger black ship to sea using its the larger politically problematic vessel as a screen to shield his ship from the blockade long enough to escape the open water. I, again, as a big sailing fan, I thought this was a good ass scene and very exciting. And yeah, it's hooting and hollering. What'd you think?
No, it's a lot of fun. I do love Rodriguez and Blackthorn shouting back and forth, just insulting each other, you know, in that sort of jovial ball-busting kind of way. And with the stakes way higher, right? Like, both of these guys are perfectly willing to let the other die, even though they forged kind of a dubious friendship here. Just maybe not quite okay with it enough to make it happen.
There's the life debt kind of hanging over. I think Rodriguez genuinely appreciates the cojones of this guy.
Totally.
And I think Blackthorn had the better one-liner where he says, he calls him a black-eyed son of a shit-fested whore. But Rodriguez, when he comes back, well, your lips are on the devil's ass, the way he like jerks off the rudder.
Yeah.
And, like, it's good. Like, the physical acting on the insult is what really sold it.
Oh, yeah. Here's my question, and maybe you can explain this to me as the master of sail that you are.
Oh, I don't know about that, but.
And the master of oar that you are. So you've got one ship here that is like a pure sailing ship, right? Like, they get all of their power from the wind. You've got another ship here which has a shitload of oars along the side. And, you know, maybe the black ship has oars they can drop in the water if they want to, but they don't have them down. This other ship, the galley, has a whole bunch of oars coming out the side, and that's primarily what they use to power that ship in this moment. So the black ship is forcing the galley into the rocks, seemingly for fun. Like, this captain is just a dickhole who is like, yeah, ha ha ha, I gotcha. Just having fun, and it seems the only solution here is to get around the galley, to get around the black ship before it's dashed on the rocks. I don't understand why they can't just slow down and tail the ship out of the harbor.
That's what doesn't make sense to me either, to be honest.
Oh, thank
goodness. Once they got through the blockade, now it could be that you literally can't, like, they could have staged it in such a way that you literally couldn't slow down before you're going to hit the rocks. So the only way to avoid them is to go to try to edge them out and get out there. But I don't have a ready explanation for why that. I heard that in the book, the deal is that this is a narrow harbor, and the black ship is a sailing ship. It doesn't have sweeps. It doesn't have these oars where they can, you know, paddle against the wind, and the breeze is blowing into the harbor. If you know anything about sailing ships, is they cannot sail right into the wind. They can at most sail like a 45 degree angle off because of the black magic that is sailing. You can still sail towards the wind, but not too many points. So that this larger and faster, obviously, you can, the wind ships are much faster than, especially sustained over the oars, but they're having to tack these short 45 degree just zipper line working their way up the harbor, and that's kind of what is forcing, you know, the pilot to catch up so that, you know, that they can get through the screen at the same time. Because, I mean, the other thing that I understand is that Torunaga's ship's deck is so much lower to the water that these guys in the shipping vessels can just board it and storm them, whereas the much larger, like the European ship, is like twice its big, and because of its, I think it's called the Tumble Home, the way that the the vessel's kind of like curves inwards. It's very hard to climb without, like, you know, someone throwing down ladders and whatnot.
It's like bell shaped almost.
Yeah, it's very hard to get up there when someone doesn't want you to get up there. And like, sure, when one European ship would board another, their decks are kind of level and they'd swing across, but the Japanese can't do that. Mm-hmm. So that's why they have to like cleave to the black ship to get through that line. But once they're through, I don't know. I felt that was a little poorly staged, but
yeah.
Because, yeah, why don't you just slow down?
If it was, yeah, them trying desperately to keep up with the black ship before it got to the blockade, I would have absolutely been in on it. I would have been like, yeah, you
got
to get...
Or if they were both wind-powered, so there's only... So, like, if you're... That's one of the... You do not want to be that close to leeward shore. Like, you don't want... Because the other thing about sailing ships is they make way, like... The wind's blowing in one direction, your ship's going in the other, and the wind is pushing on your ship to generate forward momentum, but it's also pushing it sideways. So there's a difference between what direction you're wanting to go versus what direction you are going. And when you get that close to rocks, there's only so much you can do with the wind, but with the paddles, like, that doesn't apply. So I don't know. Maybe they're simplifying that whole scene so they don't have to explain the wind dynamics, and they're just counting on people not knowing.
Well, it just confused me. And I don't know anything about sailing, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, if someone else got better analysis of it, I would like to hear it myself. But I thought it's just a fiction for the sake of the audience.
So I was going to say, I don't think necessarily that Torunaga has a plan to get Blackthorn back. He's just kind of sacrificing to get out of Osaka. And I think this is something that Blackthorn should be taking note of, or more note than he seems to be at the end of this, because he seems all... you know, Twitter painted about, like, oh, Torunaga is noticing me. Oh, he's bestowing honorifics upon me. He's challenging me to swimming races. I'm teaching him how to dive. We're becoming buddy-buddy. No,
but
I don't think
that's
true,
dude. He's
playing
him a bit too, right? Like, you know, because he knows nothing about land warfare, but he's going to be their general. Because his whole thing is,
that's my only path forward. Otherwise, off with my head, because I'm a pirate and he has no use for me. Now I'm screwed. Yeah.
And this goes back to the theme of tomorrow is tomorrow. Like, me not knowing how to fight a naval war is a tomorrow problem. Yeah. Me worming my way into this lord's good graces so that I can survive this situation and become rich. That's today. What's on today's docket. And yeah, this kind of like it also... It's very Eastern philosophy, right? That presence, you know, just like stay with the moment. Don't worry about the future or the past. Just live in that present moment, which seems to really appeal to Blackthorn.
Yeah. And Torunaga is definitely noticing what kind of person, and I am too, as an audience member, what kind of person Blackthorn is. He seems to be very smart. I mean, he knows immediately what is going on pretty much in every situation.
Yeah.
I don't know about his honor yet.
Mm.
I don't know how loyal he is. The one thing that I do like is he asks first of like getting his men out of their prison, which shows me that there is some loyalty there to at least his own men. We'll see who that extends to later on. But I'm starting to have a higher estimation of this guy.
Yeah. And it looks like I also, were you surprised that Rodriguez got away with defying the captain?
No, the way he plays it off is like, he always had the advantage. There's nothing I could do in this.
I could damage the ship, you know, and tear up our own hull. But clearly this,
who's the captain to say?
To me, Rodriguez is this is a life debt paid. And it's the last time he'll probably help Blackthorn, unless they somehow... I hope, because I love Rodriguez. I think he's fucking a lot of fun. He's a lot of fun. And I hope that him and Anjan meet later on.
I think there's an opportunity for them too, because I think the black ship is headed for Macau. Yeah. And I want to say maybe Torunaga is too, but we'll see. I know...
Is that the final boss of the season? Macau and like pacifying it, taking it over, like that's winning Japan back for the Japanese,
or exposing it. I don't know.
The end of this scene, Ishido is fuming on shore. I love like his inspector general in the halfway point of battle, like, oh, there's no way they're going to escape. And Ishido, like, dryly observing, well, it looks like they made it out after all. And the next day, Ishido's squabbling with his other regent lords. And as they bicker, Iron Hands comes smirking in with a resignation letter and a refresher for the lords on feudal Japanese law. Great scene.
Dumbfounds them, these idiots. Here's, okay, another bugaboo. I'm not a huge fan of those distraction scenes. I'm also not a huge fan. Actually, I actively dislike this. Directors, please stop doing this.
Oh.
Going from pitch black scenes to direct sunlight. This is no good for anybody. I know it
stings the retinas.
It creates visual texture. I don't give a shit. It hurts my eyes. Like, it's physically painful. Stop doing it.
I think that's
this has become a trend lately. It is terrible.
I think it's the only acceptable reason to do that. Like, if you are with Paul Maudib and he's in a black desert cave and he stumbles out to the bright desert light, and you want to put the audience in Paul where he's squinting and he can't. I think that's fine. But doing it just as style points, I don't know.
You could have started with the camera on that armor in the background, which is amazing. Put it on the tatami mats, which we would love to see. Like, literally anything else but this bright-ass daylight window coming from, like, 15 minutes. That's a long scene before in the dark. Mm-hmm. A long scene. It's everything from them in the woods. Right. With it's a candlelit scene, effectively.
Your pupils are the size of dinner
20
plates.
20 minutes ago. Yeah, fuck that. Stop doing it. It's physically painful, and you know it.
I like this Iron Hands dude. He's so funny. He's got the exact same, this Hiramatsu guy. He's got the exact same affect he did with Yabushiba, where it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you were loyal to our lord. The way he does that with, it's like, do you think you can get out of this just by quitting? And it's like, we're going to impeach him with the unanimous 4-0 vote. And he's like, oh, you've got that right. But, oh, no, it can't be. You need 5 people to vote. You've only got 4. And I think Ishido, like, starts to realize it's going to be kind of a thing to get a fifth lord, isn't it? Like,
to get everybody to agree on it?
Yes. Yeah. Now that they're, like, across with each other, where Ishido's kind of, I think he let a little bit of his, like, you guys work for me attitude out at this meeting. And
it's like our Congress getting together and voting for a Supreme Court justice. Like,
right.
It's nobody wants the same thing out of this. They're going to want another Christian
for the
region,
country,
right? Like,
but in practice, you do what's best for you. And just the way that they all, like, kind of look at each other like, oh shit, and then Ishido has just, like, the tiniest of eye twitches, like, it's just really getting to him. I thought it was really funny. So we're wrapping up here. We're back on board Torunaga's vessel. He talks politics with his son a little bit, and at the same time, Mariko and Blackthorn are discussing the reasons that he left his family far away back home.
So Torunaga wants his enemy to train his troops, and his son's like, what, dad? That's totally fucked. You can't do that. That's stupid. Is that smart? Okay, let me ask you, what is Torunaga banking on here to make this work out for him? So I do think that he understands that Yabushige is greedy. Yabushige is interested in acquiring more as part of his fief. And does he think he can control them as long as he stays greedy?
I think that's what he says about, I don't have friends or enemies. He sees his men as, like, levers of wants and needs and insecurities. And he would rather someone that he can't trust because of loyalty, but he knows this is a selfish guy, will seek my own advancement. Because I understand that guy. I know what variables I can put in, and I know what decided equation, and I know how to work all that stuff out. People that, like, say, well, I'm going to do whatever you because you're my lord. That stuff, I feel like Torunaga just doesn't buy into, because his life growing up as a hostage and being passed from one lord to the next, constantly having to hide his true agenda just so he can survive and curry favor. Like, I just think he fundamentally is maybe borderline broken in how he sees, like, human exchanges, but maybe it's the exact kind of guy you need to be shogun, that has, like, that higher level pure utilitarian outlook on things, because it's very cold. It's offensive. It hurts his son to hear this.
That's the thing. In that culture, that feels like the antithesis of the way that they operate. But it feels also like heresy. You can see that the way people are actually operating is much more sort of below board, right? Nobody is actually playing with their cards up. And yeah, so he might have the right of it, even though the society would say, well, you guys are horrible, right? You can't do things for greed. You have to do things for honor, and you must follow your lord. You can't betray them. Well, if that's how everybody acts, then yeah, you can.
And I almost think it's like, and this is praise, but I think they're doing it better than Game of Thrones, because like Game of Thrones, you had just wretchedly naive people like Ned Stark that just really put the stock in armor and warrior virtue and loyalty and like I said, honor. Did I say armor? I meant honor. Okay. And then you had the guys like Lord Tywin, who just purely like was above it all, scheming, didn't care. I like the fact that like almost everyone in the show is a Littlefinger, but they just have different amounts of brains, you know, like it's a little bit
naive rulers who come to power, although how they stay in power as long as Ned Stark did with them being that naive is a
also
open
that they're exiting. I get it from the background information that they are exiting this period of long stability and peace that this one lord has been able to enforce over all of Japan, so that nobody is really, you know, no one's ever really been tested. Like all these five regents might actually think they have an equal shot of being the Taiko or the Shogun. So
internally,
maybe,
that makes sense.
Yeah. So like at the very top of the power, I wonder if there are any Ned Starks, because but I don't know. Cause it seems maybe like the Taiko is a pretty honorable guy too. Maybe we'll find out more because at some point they have to have an opinion on Toranaga's interior heart. Like at some point the audience will have to understand that, or else why set it up as a big reveal?
Yeah.
Like Toranaga's heart is kind of like Marcellus Wallace's fucking briefcase at this point.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about Toranaga is he tells his son, "You're going to stay in Edo with Yabushige, and you're
going to
train."
He's going to Edo, which is like the more, I guess, urban. That's kind of where.
Sorry, yeah,
that's where Tokyo is today. Yeah, and he's going to the little fishing village. Yeah,
right, because he has business in Edo. I do wonder what that's going to be.
It's got to be raising his banners, right? But doesn't he have all those banners?
I thought that was his hometown. Is Edo
it
not
is.
His home city?
Yeah, it's his province.
So
yeah.
He has banners to raise there? I would think his banners would be elsewhere.
Well, I guess you're right. Is that the most central? Because they got pigeons and stuff. So is that the central place? But that was what my thought was. Because like clearly most of his household staff went to the castle for imprisonment. But Yabushige, some of his like vassals clearly are out in the wild and until they were recalled to the castle there. So I wonder if he has more, or maybe he's got some other deals to make, or I don't know. He's going to he's going to order all of Edo province covered with houses. Like they might do some ramshackle bamboo affairs, but then when the priests show up to build their church, like, oh, so sorry, we just filled up the last plot of land as soon as we have an opening. I'm being facetious, but I wonder if he's trying to like foment some anti-Christianity to like really salt the ground there. So
sure, yeah, you promised the church, but what good is a church in a land where everybody's poisoned against you?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
So, there's also the other thing we need to talk about is Blackthorn talking about, you know, what the reason he left his family is the freedom of the water. That's essentially every sailor since the beginning of time. And it's something that because I do a little sailing on the side, and there is something about being on a sailboat in a large body of water that's completely like Americans conceptualize their car as freedom. But you got to follow you got to follow traffic, and you got to stay on roads, and you got to
obey. You're on camera the entire time you do
it. You got to worry about running out of fuel. If you're on a sailing ship, you literally can go once you get into open blue water. You don't have to worry about run. You can there's just the freedom that you have to like go wherever the fuck you want for as long as you want. The only thing that's limiting mm-hmm. is the food and water that you got on the vessel. It is kind of intoxicating.
Yeah, I understand it. But color me shocked. The pirate is bad parent. Didn't see that coming.
Privateer.
But yeah, Mariko really, really gets it. You know, she's like... Yeah. And it's interesting, too, I guess, that he left his family. She's being sort of stymied by her family, sort of smothered by her family. But now that Bintara's out of the way, I don't know what her life looks like.
The freedom talk seemed to really appeal to her.
Yep.
So the next scene, Toranaga bestows on Blackthorn a great honor as well as a great deal of responsibility. Then he asks him for a diving lesson before challenging him to another race, this time a high-stakes swim to shore. I'm not sure how high-stakes it is. What's your analysis of this?
Of the race?
Just everything. Just
Well, I was... So Toranaga essentially wants Blackthorn to train a special ops team, right? Like, do they think that they're going to be fighting a whole lot of Christians? Who are trained in the ways of the European warfare?
I think Macau, whatever crack team of Japanese Ronin they got over there, Ronin they got over there, it seems likely they've been trained in the ways of foreign fighting. And I don't know what that means because, you know, as we talked about, I think last episode, it's not that the mm-hmm. Japanese didn't have guns and rifles and cannon. Mm-hmm. It could be culturally they didn't choose to fight, but I don't even think that's true. Like, I think that like the samurai of this period, their essential weapons of war is their spear, their sword, and their rifle. You know, it was quickly overtaking the bow, but yeah. They might be playing fast and loose with that. It could just be also that like the idea that there's, what is it, like 500 guns and 20 cannon, that's essentially a battalion of troops, and it's like having a spare army that no one knew you had because you just raised them up and trained them while sure. everyone was scared. Like, that might be a decisive thing that the Toranaga can have. Mm-hmm. It's got to be one of those things, though. Either this is like something that, like, there's a fragile balance of power, and any little thing can tip it, and, you know... 500 troops armed with 20 artillery pieces, that's not nothing.
Is Blackthorn scrappy enough to actually train them to use that stuff effectively? Because that's the biggest question mark. Is he going to get out on the battlefield with the army he thinks is all trained up, and they're just going to get their asses wiped with an actually trained military?
That would be hilarious. I don't know how dramatic that would be, but that's what I'm wondering is how is he going to fake this till he makes it? Because yeah. I also think Yabushiga and Toranaga's son are smart enough to, you know, if he does too much himin and han and like pawing at mm-hmm. the ground and looking up at the sky when he's supposed to be training, they're going to be like, what, you know, like, I don't know your way of war, but I know a warrior when I see one. And this ain't it, chief.
Nope, but it gets him through today. And yep. Carpe diem, baby. Tomorrow's tomorrow is kind of the way that Toranaga views that statement, I guess. Tomorrow is tomorrow. He's like, you know, I'm here today, right now. Let's do this. I'm going to learn how to dive.
Did you look into the Hatamoto honorific that he bestowed upon
no,
him?
No, no. Forgot to.
So this is a title that essentially means like inner circle of samurai. This is the samurai that would directly wow. serve a shogun. Wow. So I think it's notable... Like, I think that's one of the reasons his men are taken aback is that he's making a foreigner this, but also he's essentially declaring, this is my interpretation, it could be wrong, it's my interpretation, he's also declaring that I am going to start a shogunate, and...
The guy who says he doesn't want to be shogun has a Hatamoto, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess this roughly translates to English as the bannerman.
Okay.
Like sure. the guys who would hold your banner on the battlefield right next and, to you. You know, yeah. Yeah, I think that makes it. So then once he bestows him this great honor, he's like, now I want you to go with a swim and teach me how to dive. I'm a visual learner.
Yeah.
I'm going to need some examples. And then after he dives about 30 times, he then challenges him to a swim. What do you think's going on here?
I can't tell if he's softening him up for this race because he really wants to beat him, but he's not sure. Because, okay, who do you think wins this race? Because to me,
here's the thing:
Blackthorne wins this race hands down. A, he's clearly the stronger swimmer if he knows how to dive, and Torunaga doesn't. But B, he's longer, and if you know anything about swimming, that length that he has is going to be a huge advantage.
That's actually true. I never thought about why taller swimmers seem to have an advantage, but in terms of
Arms are longer, they can pull more water behind them.
I wonder if there's also because this is an interesting thing in sailing, is the longer your ship, the faster you can go, broadly speaking.
And it's not just about the number of sails you can fit on it, I assume.
It's not necessarily. It's the ultimate thing that controls how fast you can go is the length on the water line. And it's some kind of ratio between the waves and the length. Like, obviously that's not true if you have enough power to like plane, but a sailing vessel never has enough power. Well, they got those fucking carbon fiber hydrofoiling shits that can go like 70 miles an hour against the wind now. I don't know how those work. That's true black magic. But back in the day, it's like, yeah, there was something about the amount of effort the ship has to spin to get out of the trough of a wave and into the next one is somehow geometrically related to the total length on the water line. So it might, but my thing is, like, all else being equal, if him and Torunaga were exactly as skilled a swimmer, exactly the same amount of stamina, which I don't think is true, Tornaga's wearing a hell of a lot more clothes.
That's
like, I thought
thing.
He would strip down to a loincloth. He just stripped down to like his innermost robe.
He's wearing denim jeans while he's trying to swim, right? Effectively. It's,
and foot gear. He's wearing it's like a sea anchor, a drogue. He's getting held back. That's like,
yeah, he's going to lose
good.
That race.
I think so. But I think my reading of ranking of this is that he just bestowed this great honor on this Englishman. And then he essentially dogs him out for the next couple hours just to prove to his men that, like, this guy will, if I say jump, he'll say how high.
Huh. Okay.
It's like a way to humble him. And then also, if he can beat him, if he can exhaust him and wear him out and then beat him in a swim, it's another. I think that's where it's. He's trying to balance the emotions of his men and the loyalties and also. Yeah, that's I think there
and ingratiate himself with Blackthorne. I think there's like a camaraderie sort of thing that is developing here, at least I think from Blackthorne's side, right? He's smiling, he's having fun, even though he's having to dive 30 times. This feels cynical from Torunaga. This doesn't feel like a thing where these men are becoming equals. It feels like a thing where Torunaga
it's a game
is gaining future leverage.
And not for nothing, Mariko gets to feast her eyes on John Blackthorne's nearly naked body.
Sure. Yeah,
his hair-covered animal body.
We've got some interesting feedback about
also, is it also
body?
The fact that, like, Blackthorne refuses to bathe? And is Torunaga having him dive in until he doesn't stink?
It comes up,
takes a sniff. You know what? I didn't quite get that dive. Take another plunge, John. Take another one.
Really just exfoliate yourself with this water.
Yeah, I can't have my Hatamoto smelling like a Hatamoto mess, you know?
Nope.
you gotta blow that stink off you.
I gotta say, I don't know who wins this race, but I really love the dive that Torunaga does after this, because it is such a, this is my first time diving, but I've seen a guy do it 35 times.
Yeah,
he's like, he almost gets there, but it's very stiff.
It's not a full on belly bust, but it's like a three quarters belly bust. It's not a clean.
It's
entry
a guy who's like, this feels weird, right? Like, going head first into water feels very strange.
Yes. Yes.
But I trust it because I've seen it 35 times. So
yes.
I don't know, that was great. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And why Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Well, is that, does that about do it then, or?
Yeah, I think that's going to do it. We've got a whole bunch of feedback that we can do.
All right, let's initiate the feedback sequence. If you want to send feedback into this year's podcast, shogun@baldmove.com. But first, if you want to know what we're doing when we're not doing Shogun, check us out on our social medias, at Bald Move anywhere. And also, if you're like, you know what? I like the cut of these Bald Move boys' jib.
I'll dance.
Can I get even more with less commercials? Have I got a deal for you? Go to support.baldmove.com. You can get all that stuff accomplished, like 30, 45 seconds, and you're good. And we'd appreciate the support. Keeps us podcasting. All right, shogun@baldmove.com. What do we got, Jim?
First up, we have a whole bunch of emails that are kind of clarifications of some stuff from last episode. So we'll start off with Gabe, who says, I want to comment on one aspect of the show I didn't think was made as clear as it is in the book, namely how important honor is to the Japanese.
Teach us European savages the ways of the noble Japanese, Gabe.
Yes, they did have someone commit seppuku after disgracing themselves, but it's especially made clear in the books through Blackthorn. Initially, Blackthorn's considered a barbarian, and the Japanese are disgusted by him and his lack of bathing etiquette. When Omi pees on him, it's considered the ultimate insult, and he's essentially disgraced, especially because he didn't immediately ask to commit seppuku. This is made clear when he's given his name, Anjin. In the book, it is explained that you must be called by your name followed by San or Sama, such as Torinaga-san or Marika-sama. However, Blackthorn is told he won't be given that honor and simply be Anjin. This is an insult that degrades him further. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a built-in understanding, I think, of how important Japanese honor is in Japanese culture through the media that we've consumed here in America. At least I think so. That's how I feel. So they didn't need to do a lot of heavy lifting there.
That's interesting because, like, when I guess Shogun first came out, that Japan was extremely mysterious to America. They were the foes we vanquished in World War II, and like some GIs had like gotten to culture, but and broadly American speaking, so like a lot of the fascination with Shogun was like, oh my god, these people eat raw fish, holy shit, they have walls made of paper and bamboo, this is exotic and makes no sense. And the miniseries.
And now I've got 6 ramen shops within 3 miles.
That's what I'm saying. Our store or the store in rural fucking Ohio, our grocery store has a sushi section now. So it's like, and I think it's like it shows an advancement and a sophistication that we've gotten in the last 40 years. But also, they just can't. You can't roll out like, oh my god, they're eating raw fish. Oh my god, like who cares? We all know that, you know. So they're like now going for true authenticity or closer to authenticity. Just tell the story without all the exoticism. But I think that that's, you know, we talk about the seriousness of religion, and I think the other thing that has been impressed upon me in the last few years is as a result of that. A lot of people think there's a universality to rules. Like if, you know, like things in your village operate the same way because your priest told you that's how God wants to do. If you go to another part of the world, you would kind of expect. So like this true clash of cultures where Blackthorn truly doesn't understand what honor means to these people. And the Japanese don't understand that Blackthorn doesn't see himself as degraded or shameful at all. Like they're doing all these things to cow and shame him. And it just makes him that much bolder. I think that's kind of delicious. Let's move on to RCM, who says, I'm listening to your second episode. There are a couple subtleties that may not come across as well in this version of Shogun. If I recall correctly, Rodriguez tried to kill Blackthorn on the galley by turning the way he did while Blackthorn is walking aft. Ironically, it is Rodriguez who is thrown overboard. Blackthorn's aware that Rodriguez tried to kill him and has still risked his life by challenging the samurai and Yabu to try and save Rodriguez. This is interesting, and if true, I don't understand why they didn't tell, because it just made Rodriguez seem like a drunk fool. Like, it seems like from the book that
it made
he
the storm
cleverly...
seem very violent, not...
Yeah, he cleverly maneuvered things while Blackthorne wasn't paying attention to wash him off the deck, and that did not come across.
Yeah.
Additionally, the Tycho chose these five regents specifically because they were unlikely to agree on almost anything as a means of protecting his son. But, I mean, surely these were the five most powerful lords, too. There's like, that seems like a facile explanation because, like, yeah, that might, if he just picked the smartest combination, then the other powerful lords would be like, fuck this, you know?
Maybe the number he chose was to balance it, five as opposed to three or seven or whatever, because he knew all those other seven would be both Christian and unbalanced.
It's like
the council.
Packing the Supreme Court, you try to get you pick the number that gives you the right ratio.
Yeah.
Jim is correct. Like some of the other converts, Mariko is given an Anglo-Christian name, Maria. So that was him greeting her. Okay.
Typical Christianity, giving people new names. All right, let's move over to Chris L., who says, great work on the podcast, dealing with the first two episodes. Although the narrative structure of the series is jumping around within the original book structure, I wanted to share a couple of interesting and amusing details that were not dramatized, but I'm confident will not be spoilers. The Pit of Despair. This is the pit where Blackthorne's men are being held. The mystery sludge it's dumped on Blackthorne and his crew is said to be rancid fish guts. Because of the cramped nature of the pit, they're forced to stand in an increasingly large puddle of fishy entrails, especially after they attempt an escape and are treated to many more buckets being showered down. Another brutal detail is that during the scuffle on the ladder, a samurai is pulled into the pit and knocked unconscious, and he's left for dead by Omi. After he awakens, he attempts to drown himself in the bucket that the sailors have been using to relieve themselves in. Needless to say, this leaves a strong impression on Blackthorne and the rest.
Because of the shame, apparently? Wow. I gotta read this novel, man. It's my number one piece of business as soon as this show's over.
Yeah, as messed up as boiling someone alive is, I feel like the book is maybe three times as messed up.
Yeah, I guess our scene is really horrific in the book, too.
Here's something that I think would have been a lot of fun to include. Blackthorne's boner. There's much attention paid to how uncomfortable Blackthorne is with the Japanese and their lack of modesty. He's said to be shocked to see a man gardening in just a loincloth. He is, of course, mortified when he finds himself naked and even more so when he's forced to be bathed. The book's not subtle about the fact that all of the people charged with this task, both men and women, are fascinated to see what kind of heat he's packing downstairs, as he is in other ways so much physically larger than they are. As he's being force-bathed, he becomes aroused, and all present are quite pleased with the resulting erectile display. This causes at first complete embarrassment, but then an outbreak of laughter from all present, Blackthorne included. This incident becomes legendary where the headman of the village continues to embellish upon this story every time he retells it.
Yeah.
That man, the juvenile, the middle schooler in me really wants to have seen that in this show.
Yeah. I do understand that this is seen as some of the more cringy material in the book. The foreigner's fascination with the European's giant penis, you know. I can see that.
Look, he's a large man comparatively. You might have natural questions.
Sure. I honestly don't understand, because like I'm given to understand that I'm 6'2". If I went over to Japan and I walked around Tokyo, people would openly stare like at me like
from
I'm a kaiju. And if I went over to China, it would be 10 times worse, because what little like acceptance of outsiders Japanese have in Tokyo, and it is very little. It doesn't exist in China at all. They'll just, like, gawk at you. In fact, in China, they'll climb you like a jungle gym. They will pose you for pictures and just, like, objectify the shit out of you. So, like, I don't understand why it is... I understand why it's considered offensive, but I don't know that it necessarily was inaccurate that if, like, 17th century Japanese people found a shepherd, they wouldn't, like, have some sexual sport at their expense, you know? But
look, I've been in the presence of Rick Smits before. Haven't seen his dong, but I was awed. I was dumbstruck by how huge he was.
How big he is, yeah.
Yeah.
As a this is an American basketball player.
I guess people might not know who Rick Smits is anymore, but he played for the Indiana Pacers back in the 90s.
Center in the late 90s, early aughts for the Indianapolis Pacers. So Indiana Pacers, excuse me.
And then finally, the Anjin. It's explained to Blackthorn that anybody below the class of samurai in Japan are not given proper names or just called by what they're known for. This, along with the fact that Blackthorn is an extremely difficult word for the Japanese to pronounce, is why he's referred to as Anjin, or pilot, which is what he does.
Yeah, because is it the R or the L that Japanese don't have like the diphthong for? Like, it's very hard. It's like kind of like rolling your tongue or
it's
speaking with
L.
like a guttural. Is hard for some Americans to do because just we don't have that in our language, so you don't get to practice it.
And the R's come across as D's typically in the phonetics. So it would be very hard to pronounce properly.
Sure. Janik, or maybe Yannick from Denmark, says in the show they changed the exchange between Blackthorn and Toranaga from the book and the old miniseries in a way that I found, that I understand if you found confusing. In the book, it goes like this. Toranaga, isn't that rebellion, yes or no? Blackthorn, yes, but there are mitigating circumstances. Serious mitigate Toranaga, there are no mitigating circumstances when it comes to rebellion against a sovereign lord, and Blackthorn says, unless you win. Makes more sense and kind of puts Blackthorn and Toranaga in cahoots, leading to Toranaga smiling for the first time. I saw a lot of people mention, this might be... like Game of Thrones when Littlefinger threw Cat's sister through the moon door, like, you know, there's a big uproar over him not saying the exact thing in the books, and I even agreed with that as a book reader. I do not understand, like, why is this exchange better than what happened in the show?
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly
like I got
better.
All of that, like, you know, I guess in the miniseries, like Toranaga, like uproariously laughs at it. And I guess in the book, he's kind of like thinks this is hilarious. But him just kind of like smiling and like, you know, sardonic appreciation of this guy's, I think, like minded view of the rules and power, I thought played beautifully.
I there's a distinction here for me, because in the show, it definitely seems like he's saying you die unless you win, and I guess he is in the book also, like, this no mitigating circumstance when it comes to rebellion against the sovereign lord. Mm-hmm. I guess the punishment would be death there, but he's saying you can do it unless you win, or you can't do it unless you win. And I don't know, in the show it felt like he was saying if you'll die unless you win, which is a little weird.
Yannick also says, an interview scene with the father, Martin, is told that Mariko will be listening in. You talked about how it could have been more advantageous to Toranaga if he did that surreptitiously. However, that would have made the following sequence impossible, where Blackthorn and Toranaga end up seemingly speaking directly to each other, even though their words pass through the translator. The audience was in doubt of the truthfulness of Martin's translation. We wouldn't be able to take the conversation. Wait, we would be unable to take the conversation they have at face value.
Sure. I mean, I'm not in favor of ever doing anything because something else needs to happen. Like, if I don't know that that's a good enough reason not to do it, if it's cooler to do it the other way, but
yeah, it makes Toranaga look more clever,
but you're right, that wouldn't have worked, certainly. All right, Martin, or maybe Martin,
Father Martin,
in his own defense.
What an honor.
One thing that struck me was the difference in how characters treat religion. These two episodes, being dogmatic was seemingly punished. When Blackthorn's initially brought to Yabashige after washing ashore, he can't help himself but to insult and attack the Portuguese priest interpreter for being Catholic, even though open antagonism at that moment seems like an obviously risky move, and indeed results in the priest demanding his death and his crewman being boiled alive. Later, the Christian Japanese lords demand Blackthorn's execution as a heretic, even though it threatens to derail their presumably meticulously planned political coup against Toranaga. Conversely, the Buddhist Japanese treat the Christianity of their comrades with either bemusement or practicality. And maybe not only just Christianity, we also see the old Taiko on his deathbed ignore his wife's pleas to think of the Buddha and turn to discussing political realities with Toranaga. Toranaga himself gains an advantage by caring little about the faith of his employees and allies while exploiting the dogma of his enemies to forestall his execution. Do the cynical have an advantage over the faithful? I know you both have religious past. You probably saw it helpful or help people as well as hurt them. What are your thoughts on this treatment in the show so far?
Man, that's like that's like I'm trying to compare Which is better in Skyrim, a stealth archer or a mage? And obviously it's a stealth archer. But
or do the unscrupulous have an advantage over the scrupled?
It depends on the society, depends on the political winds, it depends on how many iterations of the prisoner's dilemma you get to play with an individual.
They have more options available to them, I suppose, but mm-hmm. they certainly have less goodwill and allies.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I feel like that is where the cynical probably day to day have the advantage, but like in big moments in history, boy, if you can motivate a huge group of people under one banner and with some kind of unifying thing, like the mass of humanity is going to beat the cynical loner every single time. All that Sigma Wolf, Alpha Wolf bullshit. Nah, that don't stand against 100 people banding together, let alone a million. A nation of people unified.
Buntaro take out quite a few dudes. He seemed and pretty cynical. Nah.
Oh, well, he's...
I don't know.
He's depressed and maybe unhappy with his life, lot in life, but I don't know if he's cynical when it comes to Lord Buddha or whatever.
Yeah, we don't really know. But yeah, I mean, it is a thing of like... Sure, you can forsake a lot of principles and get a lot of things done in the moment and surprise people with how little you care about their arbitrary political structures or arbitrary rules. It might gain you temporary advantage, but is that long-term advantage? I don't think so.
Yeah. Keenan's next has another thought on religion. As we know, the dynamics of religion are a large part of the story. That being said, have you noticed that those who have been beheaded and were to be beheaded were all Christian? I bring this up because for much of history, it was said that without your head, you cannot enter paradise. Is the show saying something here? Also, for those who have converted, would they no longer support seppuku as suicide, even though it's seen as an unforgivable sin and you go to hell? Go to hell, Jim. It's a mortal sin, killing yourself.
I don't want to go to hell.
Very ironic. First of all, a citation needed on this much of human history. It's said that without your head, you cannot enter paradise. I don't know that I know it's a fringe belief, and nowadays some Christians that like they believe in like bodily integrity or like taking bodily up to heaven, and they don't like to be cremated and blah blah blah. I don't know about the head. That seems. Boy, it seems like we lopped off a lot of heads throughout human history for that to be something to put the brakes on the church. Church beheaded a lot of motherfuckers in Europe. But then again, I don't know. Maybe that was an insult to their mortal soul. And I'm pretty sure at least one person that got beheaded wasn't a Christian. So I don't think it's like they're it's like, you know, this isn't like, I don't know, killing a Muslim and then putting bacon in their mouth. Like, I don't think the Japanese are like deliberately disrespecting their religion. I just think it's like we pretty quick about offing people's heads and we don't give a shit about, like, you know, they're either ignorant or don't give a shit about those beliefs. And again, I don't even know those are universal beliefs. I've never heard the head thing in particular.
Sure. Somebody somewhere believes anything, right?
And also, the other thing, term that Maester Anthony taught me back when we were writing that Gods of Thrones book is this word, nifty little word called syncretism, which is what happens when two dominant religions meet. And instead of one religion overpowering the other, which almost always happens to some extent, almost never is the original religion emerge from that conquering unscathed. You know, you look at how Catholicism has been woven into the native beliefs in South America, or the Deus de la Muerta. You look at how the religion, the Catholicism has been blended with like the animistic and ancestor based religions in Africa. I gotta admit, it's assumed that something like maybe seppuku is not considered suicide. You know,
perhaps.
It's like a willingness to die for your Lord, because what kills you, and even by then, you even saw the guy setting up behind, I forget the guy, that's Fuji's husband. But by this time, seppuku has been so ritualized that like the second you essentially get to start to make your move with the knife to your belly, your second flops off your head. So yeah, like what really kills you,
your willingness to kill yourself
to die for, and it's
mercy.
Essentially to die for your either your family's honor or to honor your Lord. So is that like committing suicide and like, oh my God, I'm so depressed. I don't think they could say with good faith, I don't know if they see it as the same. So like, you never know how shit gets blended. You never know how the stuff is going to swirl.
And we've talked
so
about,
I have
like,
no idea.
Cynicism versus faith. And I think those things are more entangled than we give them credit for also, because the purpose of religion here, if you're talking about the higher ups, is to proliferate. Mm-hmm. That is what they want to do. They want to extend their influence. And if that means, softening a couple doctrines in order to make it more palatable to the people who they are trying to indoctrinate, they're more than willing to do that. Yeah. More than willing. Then they try and square that circle with the rest of their followers, I guess, after the fact. But that's their purpose. I mean, it's an organization that wants to proliferate.
Yeah, and the prime directive in the Catholic missionaries of the era, and the Protestant ones too, is like, get people to accept Lord Jesus and declare a salvation based on his name. All the other stuff is negotiable. You know, when is the Sabbath? Yeah. How do you view idols?
Suicide,
all that stuff. Sort of, you know, the important thing is you take Jesus into your heart. So that's why the syncretism kind of is, and religions and cultures that embrace that are much stronger. Like one of the reasons Genghis Khan was able to spread so far in Asia is that he really didn't try to change local cultures. He's like, you know, we worship our gods from the mountains, the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. You heard of them? You fucking can't. Why would you? They're not here. It'd be absurd. So you worship whatever, as long as you pay the taxes and you give us the tribute that we're asking. I don't care how you. And that stuff spread like wildfire. Christianity, it's like, what do you got? You got evergreen trees? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's part of our Lord's birth. What do you got? You got rabbits? You got rabbits and fertility festivals? Hot damn, that's springtime. That's Easter. You kind of worship the dead. You know what? We got a feast for that too. Like, that's one of the reasons Christianity spread everywhere is because it is bullshit. Like, the Christianity they practice all over the world has nothing in common with probably what Jesus, if he did exist, tried to get people to do in the Middle East back 2,000 years ago. So,
I mean, the semi-official celebrations of Christmas now over in Japan involve a lot of fried chicken from a particular chain that I don't think was around when Jesus was born. I'm not certain of that. Did Kentucky exist?
Is this Colonel Slander? Colonel Sanders Slander?
Sanders Slander, yeah. We had a lot of really good emails that, man, I gotta cut them for time. I apologize. We're running really long here. But I did want to end with what I always enjoy, which is a whole lot of unbased theories, just wild out there stuff. And Rachel wrote in with one of those, claiming not to know spoilers. Hopefully we're speculating honestly here.
I can't believe 13 years in this podcast game, you're still talking about friends and enemies, people you can trust, people you can't trust, Jim. When you know the only thing you can trust in this here life is the microphone in front of you.
That's true.
All right, let's hear what Rachel has to say.
She says, I'm wondering if in the Taiko dying flashback, if anyone noticed the meeting of eyes multiple times between Lady Ochiba and Torunaga. It's basically stated outright by Taiko that Torunaga and Ochiba had a previous relationship or could have been together. My theory is, could the heir actually be Torunaga's biological son? Or is that too soap opera-ish?
I think that you might have missed the complexity, or maybe I'm wrong. But recall what the things that the lords are pissed about, why they're calling Torunaga onto the carpet in the first episode. It's because after the lords died, he's made several marriage alliances that through purely legal means have made his fief that much bigger. And I think they're suggesting is marrying this princess was one of those marriage alliances, and he's putting a child inside of her very recently. And that's like maybe even the straw that's broken the other lord's camel's back of ambition, that they're like, this guy is, you know, we're supposed to be all kind of balanced, and he's, you know, he's out there sowing a seed, making a bunch of marriage alliances, making his estate bigger and bigger and bigger, and now we're no longer five equals or five, and yeah, I think that's what you're supposed to understand, but I could be wrong.
Does
I could
be wrong. Include them also having hooked up before?
No, as far as I can tell, no.
Okay, so the theory's alive. Keep hope alive, Rachel. That's it. That's all the feedback we got.
But there's no, I mean, oh, Tornaga's biological son, the heir actually be, Ochiba is not this, is that the mother of Tornaga's biological son? I thought that I thought that was Tornaga's mistress that is pregnant right now.
Yeah, no, the Lady Ochiba, she's talking about the flashback scenes to the Taiko dying.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that.
Is it possible that
also
after
those
his
scenes
death,
are not nearly
they're not
I
that many years ago.
There's not that many years apart because you see how the Lord's son has aged. It's not. So,
but that doesn't mean that
that's
in
your
the
right.
Past,
that,
they weren't together.
It's not his.
Now that would be a very dishonorable thing to do.
Yeah, I think he has a younger wife who's given him an heir in his old age, but also Torunaga's doing the same thing with Ochiba. So I didn't even understand the proper relationship of the Iron Fist and the lady and who's was married. So I'm trying to catch up as well as you are, Rachel. That's going to do it for our podcast. I'm taking it. shogun@baldmove.com is how you send in feedback. Hopefully we'll have more time. We won't talk as much amongst ourselves, and we'll have more time for feedback next week. If you want to know what we're doing minute by minute, day by day, pick a social media at Bald Move and go with that. Finally, we appreciate your support. support.baldmove.com if you want to get more Bald Move stuff, including our review of Dune we just had last week. We got Love Lives Bleeding next week. You got to be a club member to enjoy that, as well as ad-free feed, support.baldmove.com. Thank you for joining us on the thrilling adventure ride that is Shogun. I can't wait. I've heard through the grapevine that, as you know, a lot of the big critics, the professional ones that have companies behind them, have got the screeners and they've seen all the episodes. And I hear that episode 4 is particularly a fine banger. It's supposedly like a real showpiece episode. So
can you really
get
trust
excited.
Those people? They're playing the game of friends and enemies. You only have yourself in this life.
Yeah. I'm treating it as information. I'm not going to bank on it. I'm going to save my own judgment, but also I'm going to wear my armor underneath my pajamas on Monday night so that I'm not surprised at midnight when an absolute banger of an episode ambushes me. I'm going to be ready to go with my Daito and my Shoto. And my Honda motorcycle ready to go. That's it. Shogun@baldmove.com. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.